Welcome to this edition of the ASI cast. And today I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by Paul Feldwick. Paul, as we'll explain in just a moment, has written a new book called Why Does the Peddler Sing? But before he had a remarkable career as an author, he was one of the top strategic planners in London. He joined what was then called BMP in 1974, advertising agency. These days, BMP is probably better known as one of the Omnicom agencies and part of the DDB network. But Paul was there for 31 years, despite all the various changes in agency name. And as I say, stayed from 1974 through to 2005. So welcome, Paul.
Hi.
So, Paul, I think it would be very helpful before we get into talking about your book, or indeed your books, in a moment or two, if you could explain for this audience what exactly an account planner in an advertising agency does, or probably I should say did, because I appreciate that what they do now might be possibly slightly different.
Well, I think it has probably changed over time, and also it was never exactly the same from one agency to the next. But certainly when I started at Bose Massimi Pollitt back in the 70s and 80s, we worked quite intensively on a limited number of accounts, and we were meant to be in charge of all the research sources on that account, as well as doing a great deal of qualitative research ourselves. And that's something I think happens less nowadays, certainly. And the qualitative research was in the service of understanding the people that we were talking to, and then showing them rough versions of the advertising to try and judge what their responses would be. And that was very central to our way of working. We'd then, have access to things like retail audit data and consumer data, and we would try and pull all that together to make our best shot at whether we thought the campaign was actually achieving its goals or not, and move on accordingly. So it was a continuous and quite closely involved role.
Did you, I guess you probably also in those early days did a fair bit of media planning yourself as well, didn't you?
Did the media planning, yes. I remember, working out how to allocate TV budgets between, Tyne-Tees and Grampian and all that sort of thing, which I'm not sure I could remember how to do now. But it was a good experience at the time.
Back in those days, and I was very much around then as well, I guess, in full service advertising agencies, media people, of course, worked in pretty close sort of physical proximity to the creative teams, often on the same floor, just down the corridor or whatever. And of course, we know that with the advent of media agencies in the 1970s, that really is no longer the case. Mm. But back then, media people were perhaps more involved in the creative work. They became sort of more invested in it, I guess. And there was that closeness between departments, which I think helped both. I mean, would you agree with that? Do you think something's been lost?
Yes, I think so, although it's quite hard to say exactly why, because even then, I mean, what the media buyers did was quite different from what the creative people did. And I would say the relationship between those departments was always sort of friendly, but never that close, because they didn't really have to work together that much. But as you say, I think invested in is a very good way of putting it, because I think everybody who worked in media, even if their daytime job basically depended on picking up the phone and shouting a lot at TV stations, they actually knew exactly what the advertising was that they were presenting. And they felt, I think, an ownership and a pride in it, so that, we all felt we were very much part of the same agency. So I think in all sorts of subtle ways, it probably did have an impact on what was done. And we were all trying to achieve the same thing in terms of the responses that we were trying to get from the public.
Yeah. I mentioned you've written a couple of books. I mean, the one that has been out now for a while, I think it's called The Anatomy of Humbug.
That's the one.
And that was all about, I think, sort of how to think differently about advertising. Your new book, I think, is out next month, March. Yes, March, isn't it?
Exactly. And that's called, I have some copies of it already, and I think it's just coming into the pipeline now, so you can order it certainly, and hopefully it'll be with you in a few days.
If you missed that piece of subliminal advertising, then it's called Why Does the Peddler Sing? Yeah. And what it's about, I guess, is what creativity really means in advertising. And I think you make the point, and maybe you could expand a bit on this, about how, despite our sort of, you know, we've got this sort of current obsession, it seems, with sort of rationality and logic. But the truth is that people do quite like to be entertained. I think you say somewhere that people do indeed buy from clowns. And if we just set aside political parties for a moment, people do like buying stuff from people who are amusing. Yeah, from clowns. Yeah. Why do you think we've got to this point? Why? What's driven this?
Well, I think there are two issues, Brian. I think one goes back a long way and one is a bit more recent. The first one is that from very early on, the sort of the way in which we are supposed to talk about how advertising works has been dominated by this idea of rational persuasion. And when you think about it, so much of our language, so much of our methodologies have been built around that. We always talk about propositions, we talk about messages, we talk about consumer benefits, we talk about reasons why. The whole premise fundamentally is that advertising is giving people reasons to choose this product rather than that one. Quite rational reasons for which you need to attract their conscious attention and then present them with a sales argument. Now, that's not entirely wrong because that does have a lot to do with it, but it doesn't have as much to do with it as we probably think it does. And it leaves out a huge amount of what advertising has done over the years as well, which is what has become a sort of dirty word in advertising, I think, for a very long time, is this notion that what we should do should be entertaining. As you say, it was Claude Hopkins who said, people do not patronize a clown. David Ogilvy said, don't sing your sales message. Selling is a serious business. I mean, even Sergio Zimon recently said, advertising that just entertains does not work. I mean, they assert these things. But it's not true, I don't believe, because I think advertising also works. And perhaps most importantly, it works through other psychological methods. I mean, we've had a great deal of work from Byron Sharp and the Ehrenberg Bass people recently talking about advertising is very simple. It mainly works simply through building mental availability, as they call it. Now, a simpler word for that, although it may not be quite as precise, is advertising makes things famous. And it makes things famous in the same way that other things become famous, the same way pop stars become famous, or, you know, celebrities become famous, or movie franchises or books become famous, actually, because they give people some kind of pleasure and therefore they want to buy into them and they want to talk about them and they want to share them, and it becomes part of a popular wave. Now, historically, in the book, I trace the sort of roots of that going right back to Phineas Barnum in the 19th century, who was perhaps the first and greatest exponent of using the growing sort of mass media of the day in order to make things famous. And the first brands like Quaker Oats, brands like Coca-Cola, brands like Lever's Sunlight Soap, they all follow exactly the same kind of techniques when they want to become famous. Yes, they use a certain amount of rational persuasion. They talk about the purity of the soap or the tastiness of the oats or whatever. But what they're mainly doing is they're presenting in all sorts of ways a great carnival of entertainment and spectacle, which attracts people's, not just attention, but attracts people's enjoyment, makes them want to become a part of it. And they're doing it in a way that's sufficiently distinctive that people always remember, yes, it's Quaker Oats because that's the one with the Quaker guy, or it's Coca-Cola is the one with the bottle that's shaped like that and so forth. So this is how brands are built. They're not built primarily through rational persuasion. They're built simply by making things famous.
Mm. I mean, obviously the B in BNP, for those in the audience who aren't aware of this, is a gentleman called Martin Bowes. And Martin Bowes, I think, quite famously said, and I think you quoted him in your book, saying that he always felt that if you were invited into someone's living room for 30 seconds, the very least you should do was to show them something interesting and enjoyable. Now, obviously, at the time that Martin wrote that, we were talking about a time of very large audiences and fairly limited number of media channels. What do you think Martin would have made of the sort of extreme number of channels we have these days?
Well, I mean, you could ask Martin yourself, actually, because he is still alive.
Yes,
and it would be interesting to know what he would say. But I think he would think that nothing has fundamentally changed. Whatever medium you're using, if you're going to invite yourself into somebody's lives, he would work on the principle. And it started almost from an ethical point of view, even before it was about effectiveness, that, you know, why would it be a good idea when you have a chance to contact somebody to insult them or annoy them? Wouldn't it be better to actually be attractive to them? I think this word attention has been quite a dangerous one in some ways throughout the history of advertising. I know there's a lot of good work going on about it at the moment, which is getting more sophisticated, and it's measuring the length and the type of attention rather than just, but you see, attention can mean so many different things. Attention can mean, oh, that sounds really interesting. I like the look of that. I like the sound of that. I'm going to go and get more of it. That's one kind of attention. But on the other hand, attention can equally mean somebody jumping out in front of you and shouting boo at you and giving you a fright. That, you know, made you stare. That got your attention. And I fear that that latter meaning of attention is more or less what so many of today's practitioners seem to think it means. Because when I go online and I'm trying to do something else, you know, the number of pop-up windows that still jump out in front of me when I really don't want to see them. And I think, why are you doing this? You know, it doesn't achieve anything from your point of view, and it simply pisses me off. So I think the same principle was what Martin was talking about. There was so much advertising at the time, as in all eras, that was irritating. And people did complain about TV advertising and say, you know, this comes on and it shouts at me and it repeats the same things over and over again, and I'm bored with it. And Martin thought, well, why is that the best way of advertising? Now, you can argue that it does achieve something. If you do enough of it, things will stay in people's minds. It will leave a trace. But actually, I think we all believed at BNP that it would be ultimately much more effective and efficient if, rather than just irritating people to death and banging things into their heads, we actually could charm them, if we could be a sort of a charming guest, as Martin, I think, used to sometimes put it. And he said, if you do that, then they may like you a bit more, and then they'll be more likely to buy your product. I was writing the book, this very powerful image came into my mind, which I originally got from The Winter's Tale. This is actually Autolycus in The Winter's Tale on the cover from a Royal Shakespeare Company production. And the peddler at the door arrives in The Winter's Tale. And it's clear everyone's so excited that the peddler has come because he sings all these wonderful songs. And I just thought, well, imagine back in the days before there were any mass media, somebody turns up the door singing and telling jokes. You invite them in. Now, why does the peddler sing, to coin a phrase? It's not just to attract attention, although that may be the start of it. It's actually because he wants to be invited into the house, and he wants to stay there, and he wants to create an ongoing relationship. And he wants to put people into a mood where they're more likely to part with their money because they like him and they're feeling more relaxed. And I think that those processes, those psychological processes, are not difficult to understand. And yet they've so often been underestimated by people who think that advertising has to be a serious business of selling or a serious business of just hammering sales messages into people's heads.
And it's very interesting, isn't it? I mean, there's plenty of research around, certainly recently, from the Advertising Association, amongst others, that points out that advertising is actually less popular these days than it once was, in fact, probably than it's ever been. It's at the sort of height of unpopularity at the moment. Mm. And I know that does vary by channel, as it were, or by wherever you're seeing the advertising. It isn't completely the case, but it's very largely the case that the least popular media forms are those online media forms, social media forms that you referred to just now. But in the book, you explain why you think this is, and you place the blame, such as it is, at the door of sort of less entertaining sort of creative, and yet clients are buying this stuff, aren't they? I mean, someone's buying it. So why do you think that is?
Agencies can be very persuasive to their clients. I see this happening. And I think that, yes, a lot of responsibility lies with clients who perhaps should know better. But I think that a lot of responsibility also lies with agencies. You see, I think what has happened is, apart from the first thing that I was just talking about, is this belief that advertising was about simply communicating messages and it was about selling rather than entertaining. But I think that in more recent years, we've got another problem, which is that the agencies themselves have lost interest in producing work that's genuinely popular. And by that, I mean, perhaps most strikingly, the creative departments seem to have lost interest in creating work that's genuinely popular. I think that has something to do with the importance that has become attached to creative awards, which are increasingly sort of given because creative people are trying to please other creative people rather than trying to please the public. And I think that's become now quite dangerous. They're also increasingly trying to do other things, like show they have a sort of worthy purpose, which may or may not have anything to do with actually selling stuff, a separate issue, which, as you know, Steve Harrison has written quite a sort of polemical book about, which I have some sympathy for. But I think it's nevertheless the case, and there seems to be evidence from the analyses of the work by Peter Field and Orlando Wood's excellent book, Lemon, which came out recently, are taking these things apart in more detail, perhaps even than I do, and pointing out that today's creative work is not often enough genuinely pleasing the public. I go back to where we started. You know, I spent a great deal of my time when I was a young planner literally doing qualitative research, showing animatics to groups and seeing how people reacted. And honestly, if people just sort of sat and stared at it in glum silence or said, oh, that's very boring, or I didn't understand a word of it, it was very hard to come back and say, I'm really enthusiastic about this ad. You know, I was looking for something a bit more positive than that. And I think that's why BMP in the 70s and 80s produced such a lot of very successful, very popular campaigns. I mean, it had a lot to do with John Webster and a lot of other very talented creative people that we had there at the time, of course, as well. But that system in which we made sure that what we were doing was actually popular, I think, was central to it. And I don't think enough of that goes on nowadays. If there is research, it's not necessarily the right kind of research, although that is changing. I think people like System One are doing better ad research now than used to be available. I suspect in a lot of cases, you know, it's not really being checked out at all, which is why when I look at ads on the TV today, I often look at them and I think, I'm not quite sure what this ad is about. I'm not quite sure what it's trying even to do. But I can see it conforms to a set of conventions that makes it look like an ad is supposed to look like in 2021, which means it might be in with a chance of winning an award. I mean, there are exceptions. There are still, I think, some great campaigns. Specsavers, should have gone to Specsavers, has a strong distinctive asset. Entertaining ads, good production values, a good example of getting into people's living rooms, and I think it's been very effective, although somebody recently told me they've just discontinued it, which is what too often happens. The other one I, of course, have to speak up for is, you know, these guys, who I think have been, although I think they've lost their way a little bit recently, personally speaking, but I don't know, you know, they may still be doing the business, but, you know, you can't go wrong with a furry animal, I think, as we used to say back in the 70s. And, you know, they're quirky, they're funny, they are entertaining. And, you know, they tick all the boxes, really, because they also tie into this fantastic promotion where, you know, you get sent the toys. And it's followed through in wonderful detail. It says here, official product of Miyakova, it says on the back of this. So, you know, the whole thing is so thought through. It's like putting on a show rather than trying to sell us stuff. And at the end of the day, that's still what people like.
Yeah, it would have been quite amusing to have been in the room when whoever it was at VCCP first sold that into the client. I mean, so we're going to build this campaign around the confusion between meerkat and market or something.
Yeah.
And we're going to feature these furry animals. A brave client, you know, and great.
It was a brave client, and all credit to them. I mean, I was actually doing some work with VCCP about the time this was happening, not on this account, but I had various conversations with people there about how it was going. And I think it's clear that the client sort of bought into it without too much trouble, as I understand it, and went for it. And I think they very quickly discovered that it worked fantastically well. I mean, it worked so well that they've never done an IPA effectiveness award because they do not want to tell their competitors how well it's doing.
So when you were just finish with a couple of questions about, going right back to when you were kind of starting, quite often people will sort of say things like, indeed, you've quoted David Ogilvy, and I know you've, in your book, you quote Birnbach a lot. I mean, when you were starting out, did you pay a lot of attention to the people who came before you, as it were? I mean, were you a great student of advertising?
When I started out, no, absolutely not. I think, like everybody else in the agency, we thought we knew it all. We weren't very interested in the past. We weren't very interested in what we could learn from any other agencies. You know, we thought BNP just knew everything and everybody else was wrong. We were quite arrogant, which served us quite well in some ways. But then later on, as time went on, I think possibly what triggered it for me was, I think it might even have been this book. I came across this in a junk shop or somewhere, Madison Avenue, USA, 1958. You probably know it. If not, I'm sure you will. Brilliant journalist, Martin Mayer, who did just a sort of wonderful description of what was going on in Madison Avenue in the 50s. And I read through this with real excitement, because all the things that I'd been sort of taught were somehow, you know, inevitable and the way advertising had to be. Things like, why do we measure awareness, or why do we measure recall, or, you know, how does these, I suddenly realized, were not the only way it could be done. They just happened to be particular concepts that particular individuals had invented at some point in the not too distant past, actually. And they'd invented them not necessarily on the basis of any great science or theory, but actually just because it seemed like a good idea at the time, and some of these things caught on. So this was where I started discovering about the history of, George Gallup, or starch ratings, and how TV ads were researched and why they were researched the way they were. And I think that was the beginning of a lengthy period of inquiry where I gradually picked up more and more threads. And I suppose over about 20 years, these things gradually sort of settled in my mind, and I did a lot of talking about it and teaching and so forth. And that eventually led me to writing The Anatomy of Humbug, which was my attempt to pass on a sort of digest of everything I thought I'd learned to other people. And I think that's worked reasonably well from the feedback that I've got on this book, that a lot of people have said to me, I had no idea about any of this, but suddenly it all makes sense. So it took me a long time to discover it. And once I'd discovered it, I wanted to sort of share it with as many other people as possible, because it seemed to me it was hugely important that if we don't understand the past, I think we have no hope of making sense of the future. And I think that may be a large part of what's gone wrong with advertising today, that it's not that it's being necessarily done by stupid people or malevolent people, but it's being done by people who have not taken any interest in what has gone before. And there is 150, 200 years of advertising and publicity history, which is actually profoundly relevant. And if we're interested in saying, you know, suppose we're looking towards a post-TV future, it might be interesting to see what a pre-TV past looked like. Mm. Of course, we'll never go back. We'll never go back to how it was. But what we can try to understand is, what are the underlying principles about what was happening in very different media landscapes? I mean, we all grew up, I guess, in what proves to have been a very stable and long-lasting period for the media landscape. I mean, from 55 onwards, from the start of commercial TV, the media landscape in the UK was very, very settled. I mean, it didn't change very much. There was one and then maybe two commercial channels, which reached very large audiences. It was a fantastically powerful medium. And we all based our campaigns very much around that. Now, that has started to unravel, and it will eventually, I think, unravel to an extent that it's kind of unrecognizable. And meanwhile, the internet, of course, has come in. It's surprising to think the internet, as we know it, has been around for at least 25 years, and we're still kind of debating what's the best thing to do with it. Whereas commercial television, I mean, people got it in about 18 months, and that was it, settled. But I think what we can go back and say, you know, TV advertising at its best, the sort of stuff that we were doing, it's doing the same thing as the peddler at the door used to do back in the Middle Ages, or the mountebanks or the traveling medicine shows. They're going around, putting a smile on people's faces, making them become part of a relationship, and using that as a way of selling things and making things famous.
It's a very good point. I wonder who the peddler at the door is now. Yes. If TV was the peddler at the door, as it were, the equivalent. I mean,
I guess, you know, because people want to watch them, although most of them leave me fairly cold, but then I'm not in that target audience. But for a younger generation, you know, somebody who is that you recognize as somebody like you, somebody like, you know, Charlie D'Amelio or Zoella or somebody, is presumably the peddler at the door because you have that relationship. Mm. You like them. You want to invite them into your life through the media of, you know, social media or whatever. And you're very, therefore, open to being sold stuff by them. Now, I'd like to think there's probably more interesting stuff that can be done than somebody just talking about a pot of cold cream in their bedroom. But, you know, if that works, I can't knock it. I think it's another version of it. I mean, the other version of the peddler at the door today, of course, is characters like, say, Kylie Jenner, or, Kylie Jenner would be a very good example, celebrities who have become very, very famous through, say, reality TV or something like that, who then launch their own brands. That, again, is not a new thing, but it's taken its own particular flavor today. Because, again, here is somebody who is, first of all, an entertainer. You see, you think about the peddler. Does the peddler decide that he would sell more ribbons if he sang some songs? Or was he a singer who just realized he'd make more money if he sold some ribbons? Could have been either. Probably was both. So I think, you know, Kylie Jenner launching a range of cosmetics is an entertainer who suddenly thinks, how can I make some money out of this? Well, I have 100 million followers or whatever it is. I'll launch a range of cosmetics, and if even half of them buy it, I'll be very rich, which she is. So I think if there is this long tradition that stretches from very ancient times to modern times. And, you know, in that perspective, TV commercials are a particular variation that happens somewhere in the middle of that process. But the fundamental principle of the peddler at the door, I think, remains the same.
Brilliant. Well, it's been absolutely delightful talking to you, Paul, and just to restate for the audience that the book is called Why Does the Peddler Sing? I've been lucky enough to be in centre and advance the manuscript of it, and it's absolutely fascinating. So thank you very much indeed for joining us today,
Paul. Well, thanks very much. Thank you.